Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm happy to be joined by Christopher Ocker, who is the director of the Program of Medieval and Early Modern Studies in the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. And he's also a member of the core doctoral faculty of the Graduate Theological Union at Berkeley. Christopher has written broadly on the Protestant Reformation, religious politics, and theology in early modern Europe. And he's here today to talk to us about a book that was released with Cambridge University Press in 2018 titled Luther, Conflict in Christendom, Reformation Europe and Christianity in the West. Christopher, congratulations on the book and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Zach. Glad to be here.
Great. Well, it's great to have you here. Christopher, before we talk about your book, could you first tell our listeners a little bit more about your own background and some of your own academic interests?
Sure. I have the PhD from Princeton Seminary, a program where we really stressed the study of theological literature and the history of theological literature. I'd also done seminars in history at the university with Peter Brown and William Chester Jordan. They had a great impact on me. And then while writing my dissertation, was resident, a fellow at the Institute für Europäische Geschichte in Germany. And those experiences gave me a really deep interest in the history of theology, but also in social history in the Middle Ages. I was trained as a medievalist, and also in the Reformation and the medieval background to the Reformation. So that's something that's stayed with me through my entire career. And then I've taught at the Graduate Theological Union and the San Francisco Theological Seminary for many years, and part of my remit was teaching the Reformation and collaborated very closely with Tom Brady, a professor at Berkeley in the history department, who's a close friend and served as really a mentor to me over the years. And that's pretty much what set me in the direction I followed.
Very good. Well, Christopher, as we turn to your book and we think about Martin Luther, it's just a dominant figure in the religious literature of 16th century Europe. There's really been no shortage of work done on him, especially in terms of his ideas. But in your book, you argue for a new perspective on Luther that sort of incorporates the various responses to Luther and debate over him. And so what we don't get is a lot of the typical biographical bits, which you mentioned that there in the introduction of a more personal approach, but instead you give us more of an impersonal sketch that kind of fills out these social political controversies that surround him. I'm wondering if you can sort of comment here on sort of your approach to this project as a whole, what stirred the idea, and maybe how you undertook the research with this broader gaze, broader gaze towards Luther's international reception, even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess uh, You know, I was conscious of the fact that the 2017 anniversary of the beginning of the Reformation, as you know, people say in shorthand, was generating a lot of renewed interest in Martin Luther individually. That kind of replicates what happened 100 years ago in the 400th anniversary of the Reformation, kind of spawned a movement that church historians have called the Luther Renaissance. And it was really at that time that Luther individually, as a kind of theological genius, began to dominate the perspectives of church historians in particular on the Reformation, what the Reformation was. There were some church historians who began to say at that time and afterwards, really all through much of the 20th century, that the Reformation was kind of a personal achievement of Luther. There was a lot of interest in identifying what was, you know, the key idea, and, you know, different people emphasized different things. One that sort of stuck the longest is probably the idea of Christian freedom as, you know, something that had huge historical impact. And scholars started writing essays about how Luther was the beginning of the modern world, and they made a lot of really grandiose claims. And I guess I felt very impatient with that. I thought that kind of a perspective at that time made a lot of sense as a way of describing Luther's relationship to the culture of a nation state. Luther came to assume a lot of importance in German identity. There were debates about, you know, how Luther is related to Catholic identity in Germany, you know, is it just Protestant and that sort of thing. In fact, the founder of the Institute for Europäische Geschichte in Mainz, Josef Lortz, one of the founders, was a Catholic Church historian who made part of his career as a kind of reclamation of Luther, as a figure who may have gone wrong, but actually had a constructive relationship to the Catholic Church. All of those trends were really influential in 20th century intellectual history. Of course, there's a lot more to it than that. But partly what I wanted to do was try to come up with an alternative that just did not really depend on the idea that an individual and their personal charisma or genius was a generator of historical change. That kind of converges with the way historians operate. We try to, synthesize a lot of evidence, really diverse evidence, hyper-contextualize things, look at the developments of things as dependent on circumstances and not just happening within circumstances. So, it also gave me an opportunity to try to synthesize a lot of recent historical research, and I hope to do it in a fresh and I hope an insightful way. Yeah.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you call the book sort of an anti-biography, and you make these really clear distinctions that I appreciated about what you're doing in the work from what you're not doing. And as you talk about in the introduction, you're really drawing out the controversy and conflict surrounding Luther. That's a really big theme. Mm-hmm. You get right to it, even in the first few chapters. So as we look at these first two chapters, I'm wondering if you can tell us sort of who are the primary allies and adversaries. Many of these players with their own religious allegiances that were participating in the political, social, religious controversy that Luther was right in the middle of.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who appear there, so that's not an easy question to answer. What happens in the first chapters is I describe a lot of noise that's happening around Luther without talking very much about what Luther himself is trying to do. And the noise is really centered around the accusation of heresy, the Luther's eventual condemnation, and then what happens after that. And what to me the most interesting thing that happens, and actually, if you will, if you could call this a character or a protagonist in the story, the most interesting, this is kind of, I don't know, can you have an abstract protagonist, a protagonist that's not a person? The real protagonist is not actually Luther, but the controversy about Luther and the fact that it doesn't really have a clear resolution. I think that this lack of resolution, the fact that, you know, that Luther receives this very unequivocal condemnation, there's no judgment that is actually carried out. So that proves to be impossible. And then what happens in the wake of that failure to, you know, essentially, the thing that didn't happen was Luther wasn't brought to Rome, and essentially some decisions about how to punish Luther were never really made. So presumably, if he had been brought to Rome, he probably, we don't really know, but he probably would have been executed as a heretic. So that's kind of what you would expect, since he couldn't really be called anything but a contumacious heretic, a stubborn heretic, someone who, you know, was really not going to let go. And that was justification for a death penalty. So probably that's what would have happened. Didn't happen. And that gave people an opportunity to equivocate about that judgment. Not just, you know, people who clearly supported Luther, like the preachers and priests and who embraced his ideas and carried them out, or some of those others who adapted Luther's ideas, particularly in rebellions and cities. City councils eventually, and then over time, princes unambiguously supporting Luther's position in the conflict. All of those people, you know, Luther's supporters, they all kind of eventually take a certain shape and a political form. They form a coalition, the League of Small Calden. That becomes a really important center point of the Protestant movement. But also people who is accepted the Luther's condemnation of heresy could still equivocate on what he was teaching. And those equivocations, I think, are just really interesting. And they tell us a lot, in my mind, they tell us a lot about the texture of religious debate in that society at the time. So, you know, one of the points that I try to emphasize in the beginning chapters of the book is that this is a controversy that never actually comes to an end. It never comes to a conclusion. And over time, what happens is, as it gets dragged into the politics of the Holy Roman Empire, the main political organ of the Holy Roman Empire, the Imperial Diet, comes to a position where they accept Protestants, even though they are religious heretics by any proper definition, of course, not to Protestants. So you have the situation, and a lot of that actually, that development hinges on debates over church property that are unleashed by the religious movement. You know, when a town takes, you know, town decides that, you know, these priests are actually not teaching the gospel, so we're going to appoint people to take their place. Well, they're infringing on property rights of those priests, on the people who appoint them, the properties that support those ministries, and so they end up giving birth to a very large number of lawsuits that eventually force the Imperial Diet, so the political body of the Estates of the Holy Roman Empire, to reach a compromise that says, okay, we'll let people who, you know, belong to this group, they end up, you know, essentially it's the religion represented and defended by the League of Small Calden, which, you know, the centerpiece of that is the Augsburg Confession, the 1530 confession that was debated at the Imperial Diet in Augsburg in in 1530, the Augsburg Confession, you know, becomes the kind of the defining thing for that group. They say, well, yeah, we'll let them use their property under all sorts of conditions that, of course, you know, spawn all kinds of additional conflicts. So, yeah, there are a lot of interesting little things that happen in a generation of experiences that yield that compromise. But the long and the short of it is, it ends up being a debate that is where the parties agree that they're going to disagree.
Very good. Well, Christopher, you go on to talk about the political anatomy of the Luther affair through next chapter. And you detail these various contextual dimensions that sort of explain both the depth and then the persistence of the Luther controversy. Can you talk to us about how you're demonstrating the connectedness of these various dimensions and what you describe as a genuine symbiosis between these religious players that are involved?
What I try to do, so there's, you know, part of what I described has a certain kind of has an accidental quality. I'm trying to say, look, there is a lot of stuff that just happens. You know, it's in the stuff that just happens is the familiar stuff of the Reformation. It doesn't have a necessity bound to it. It's not like Luther had this idea, and of course that idea, you know, meant that people had to reject the priesthood and oppose the papacy or persecute Anabaptists, whatever you want. Rather than say that, I've tried to say, look, there are all these things that happen. So in this somewhat chaotic array of things, where do we find shape and form? What are the patterns that prove to be the most influential over time? So rather than an influential individual, what are influential patterns, or what patterns indicate influence over time? And to my thinking, and I suppose there would be others as well, the ones that are quite unique to the religious controversy, that is to say, they have a shape that is clearly closely related to the religious controversy, are four, which I describe as dimensions. So one would be a papal dimension, another I call a conciliar dimension, another an imperial dimension, and finally a property dimension. And these four dimensions, it seems to me, operate a little bit distinctly, but they also overlap. So, for example, the papal dimension consists of the condemnation of Luther, but then also the attempt to prosecute heresy and prosecute Lutheran heresy afterwards. And I think what's, you know, if you look at this in the impersonal way that I'm proposing, what's really interesting about that papal dimension of this religious conflict is not just that, you know, a certain viewpoint is stigmatized, but that viewpoint is stigmatized so aggressively, and that stigma is communicated so thoroughly that it seems to me perfectly reasonable to say that one of the great engines of spreading this conflict and making it a continental affair is actually the papacy. The alternative to that is to describe the continent-wide interest in Luther and debate over Luther as something that's generated by people who take Luther's ideas, they learn them in Wittenberg, and then or by reading a book, and spread them in other places. And of course, there's a lot of that happening too. But when you look closely at the spread of those ideas, what you discover is that they're not all strictly Lutheran. They don't all, you know, correlate really closely necessarily with Luther's own teachings. Sometimes those preachers coming out of Wittenberg, we may network with Wittenberg. Sometimes they end up being quite independent. There are a lot of ambiguities in the kind of image that gets communicated through that kind of personal individual spread of teachings. Not so with the case of heresy. It's a really firm image that gets communicated. This guy's a heretic. Here are some laws. This is why it's wrong. This is what's going to happen. And then, wow, you suddenly see a few people, learn of a few people who are actually being executed for this. That does a lot to communicate not just a particular position in the debate, but also the character of the debate as something really big. It helps make it big. So the papal dimension. The conciliar dimension is really interesting because early on in this conflict, there is an appeal to a church council, and that becomes that appeal to a church council. Luther makes an appeal. He appeals his case to a council, and that becomes an important element of basically postponing any further action. It allows both the papacy, the Holy Roman Emperor, and the Pope actually is a bit ambiguous about this, but some popes actually support the idea, and the Holy Roman Emperor and the German estates, the Catholic German estates, to agree that that the condemnation of Luther is not a final judgment, so that there remain open questions about this character, and it's what basically allows the Protestants to continue their case, and particularly in the Imperial Diet, a faction of the estates, it allows them to, a few of the princes and some cities, to promote the idea that the reforms that Luther is proposing actually counts as orthodoxy, and then that imperial dimension of this conflict gets carried over into the property debate. And the property debate, as I said before, is really a very concrete way that people end up arguing about whether or not the new teaching can be basically continued in one place or another. Those old things are not only concurrent, but they're kind of mutually reinforcing.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's really interesting about your book, just in addition to the detail on the controversy in Luther's day and these various dimensions, is that the controversy about him, it went into years after his death and after Peace of Augsburg, 30 Years' War, into the Enlightenment, and all the way into, you know, how he's been appropriated into American revival. Can you talk to us about how you're engaging all of these really wide-ranging sources, and maybe speak to how the controversy around Luther has contributed to Christianity as a whole, more broadly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. I think that's it's really important to think about these things, and also really interesting to think about them. You know, like it seems to me that to talk really broadly about this, that the situation of this unresolved controversy and the kind of détente that gets established, you know, we associate it mostly with the Peace of Augsburg in 1555. It's more interestingly complicated than that, but that is a good signpost. One of the interesting things about that is it creates this environment of religious competition. So you end up having a multiple of groups who claim to be the more accurate representation of the true Christian faith, and all theologians who are actually quite important professionals and educators and courtiers at the time, they all agree that that Christianity is a singular religion. It's represented by the creed. There is one Holy Catholic Apostolic Church. It is confessed by all all these churches. The only exception to that would be some of the Anabaptists, who are truly brutally persecuted. The one true Christian faith. So, you know, really what happens is you have a situation of that's created of competing orthodoxies. I think there is in conflict that a conflict, this is an idea that comes from the early conflict sociologist Georg Simmel, that in a conflict, what matters is not just the way in which parties oppose one another, distinguish each other, but there's a relationship that's created between those parties, and that relationship can form a kind of codependence. And I think that's really present in Catholic and Protestant conflict after the Reformation. So, you know, historians have frequently described in recent years, up until recent years, they've described the Reformation as producing confessional states. And so you have states that, you know, form a kind of coherent idea of what the society is around its Catholic or Lutheran or Calvinist confession. And I'm not really satisfied with that, because it suggests the, and many historians, it's become sort of a cottage industry of sort of picking at this idea and trying to pick it apart and criticize it. So I'm like totally unoriginal in doing that. But the to me, you know, one of the big problems with it is that it relies on the notion that a confessional state is very socially and culturally cohesive, and it's that cohesiveness that really matters. That had the advantage for historians to you know, appreciate religious interests, debates, and also theological ones. So the theologians play a really important role in developing confessional identity. There's some church historians, the Göttingen church historian Thomas Kaufmann, for example, has emphasized this very productively. They play a really important role in sort of assuming the role of experts who can, you know, define what culture is and the terms of, you know, Lutheran confession, all that. Well, the view that I'm proposing here is a little bit different. It's suggesting that what matters here is not the coherence of the view, but the interdependence that is created by, you know, juxtaposing your position to, as let's say, a Lutheran position over against a Calvinist or Reformed or Catholic position. And I think there's, you could even go so far as to say that there is a sense of affinity, that that religious affinities are relative, and that the three main confessions have a sense of affinity with each other over against other larger religious differentiations, like the difference between Christians and Muslims or Christians and Jews. What I'm trying to do in this book is view the effect of the Reformation as the creation of a kind of cultural pluralism that has a certain dynamic. Yeah, it's true. Confessional identity is like something quite important, but it's not necessarily in and of itself a totality. And it might be better to think of it as a piece of a larger totality. Let's call it Christendom. The contrast and also the conflict between Christendom and Islam, as, you know, they commonly perceive the Ottoman Habsburg competition in the 16th and 17th centuries, is perhaps equally, maybe even more definitive. I think if we start thinking in these terms, we can look at pluralism as something that is it doesn't create a very peaceful society, but it is, you could say, socially productive. So the variety is something that, you know, helps people think of multiple ways that they're associated with each other and others. So yeah, sure, I might be closer to this as a Lutheran. I might be closer to this other Saxon Lutheran over here. We have all these debates about whether or not this, we and Calvinists even belong to the same religion, or Catholic, are we closer proximity to Catholics? You can detect a lot of those kinds of things in debates over the Eucharist and predestination, all kinds of, you know, interesting theological problems. But there's also this consciousness that Christendom actually still, even with all these debates, that it forms a block over against Islam. I think that's actually quite important for the development of European consciousness. And that sensibility changes over time. And eventually, just to be really brief about it, in the 18th and 19th centuries, it changes into a more, you could say, a more pacific kind of pluralism, where the world is perceived to basically have far more religious differentiations within it, and that, it seems to me, is far more like what the world looks like right now than the idea of a confessional state. So, I think what I'm trying to do, I'm not explaining this very well, but what I'm trying to do is suggest a way to think of the effect of the past on the present that embraces pluralism as a productive element of religious conflict within Europe.
Yeah, well, Christopher, I think you explained it well, and I think you've really demonstrated the complexity of the Reformation and showing how it sits upon these different interests and opinions of people at different levels throughout society, and you've also demonstrated diversity of opinion on Luther that's gone on even into the present. Christopher, with this book now a few years behind you, and now before we wrap up today, can you share with our listeners what you've been working on recently, what they might expect from you in the future?
Sure, thanks. Right now, I'm finishing a follow-up to this book, which will probably have the title Hybrid Reformations, that I hope will be out next year. What I'm looking at there is, in this next book, it's a narrower focus on certain social and intellectual dimensions of the generation of the Reformation, so Luther's generation, and before. So what I want to do is highlight and draw attention to some of the things that are marginal to the religious controversy that happen on its margins, but actually say more about what is effective and formative in the emergence of Protestantism than perhaps, the stuff that's right at its center. So those include some examples of, importantly, actually, they include people who are accused of Anabaptism. So Anabaptists, whether real Anabaptists or so-called Anabaptists, also things that happen on the intellectual periphery. So the question of nominalism is nominalism an important intellectual force, and can Luther's theology be called nominalist? And I think the answer is actually no on both counts. So I have a particular argument about that. Biblical interpretation, I've argued in another book that the idea that the literal interpretation of the Bible as a kind of Renaissance or Reformation invention is really problematic. And there's a lot of evidence in pre-Reformation school commentaries, so scholastic commentaries in the 14th and 15th centuries, that show how a conceptualization of the text as a kind of literary document with theological content develops and becomes and converges with Renaissance humanism, becomes really important in the Reformation. I'm taking another look at that idea in this next book that focuses on figurative meaning and allegory. So is the Reformation, Protestantism, something in it, or for that matter, Renaissance biblical scholarship, something inimical to allegory? And I argue, no, that's not the case at all. That misconstrues how allegory functioned in the Middle Ages and in the Reformation. So these are things that are not really at the center of of the emergence of Protestantism, the debate over the papacy, the idea of justification by faith, you know, the revisions of sacramental theology, those sorts of things, or rebellion, urban rebellions, and social movements related to that. These are kind of things on the periphery rather than the peasants' war, people struggling, people using accusations of Anabaptism to advance their property interests after the peasants' war, stuff like that. I'm trying to show how this periphery actually tells us more about the emergence of this pluralistic Europe than and the weirdnesses about pluralism within Europe than focusing on the center of religious debate.
Very good. Well, we wish you the best with your research and those writing projects. But for now, we're glad you've written this book. It's called Luther, Conflict, and Christendom, Reformation Europe, and Christianity in the West. It's out in 2018 with Cambridge University Press. And Christopher, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network.